Well, thank you all, folks, so much for coming back for part two. I am so excited to share this knowledge with you, and maybe it's stuff you've already heard before, but it's always nice to get a review. And if you really put the anatomy and physiology of migraines to work, you can understand better how to treat migraines, how your role is actually quite a large one. And if you choose to take it on, or if you want to co-care with people, which I do, it's marvelous to be able to understand the mechanisms of migraine better so that you can do proper co-caring. Last time we discussed the difference between a headache and a migraine. We discussed the epidemiology of migraine, who gets them. We talked about gender being a huge player, 3-to-1 ratio of females to males getting migraine. We talked about the genetic components. There's 20 plus genetic markers for people that have a tendency towards migraine. And so almost too many to count, and they're identifying more and more every year. We also talked about the cortical spreading depression, the concept of what's actually happening with this this downregulation of neurons that has a spreading effect over the brain that causes a massive cascade. One of the researchers calls it neuroinflammatory soup, which I love. It's just ultimately fascinating. I was talking with my husband today in preparation for the lecture, and he said, you know, I love how the world may get to experience the benefit of your experience with migraine, and that maybe you're a chosen one of sorts by the universe to experience it and then learn from it and share. That is the most beautiful way to put it. It's not like I would wish migraine on anyone, but if you were going to have to experience it, to give back to other people, to teach them what you know, is such a valuable thing. So we talked about a lot of those concepts last week, and I just wanted to make sure that there were no underlying questions. You folks are the silent wonders. And maybe that's just you know, adapting to the change of understanding migraine, and you don't want to disrupt your homeostasis, which is a big part of migraine management. But I wanted to make sure I was answering all of your questions adequately. So has anything come up since last visit based upon what we've discussed so far? We will get to treatment, I promise, but I think people jump to treatment before they understand migraine, and that's a big, big component. Does anyone have any questions? Please use the chat box if you would like to ask anything about some of the concepts. This week, we're going to go into a little bit more of the concepts of cortical spreading depression and the concepts of what, you know, creates this event called migraine. Someone asks, can fluid come out of the scalp during migraine with A&P? So I think that people are not talking about scalp fluid. I think you might be talking about cerebrospinal fluid. Is that correct? So cerebrospinal fluid leaks. If that's to what you are alluding, you are on point. So people with connective tissue disorders are people, have you guys heard of POTS? Positional tachycardia syndrome. You change positions quickly and your heart beats really fast. They've linked that to connective tissue disorders, and they're starting to link a particular type of headache that's not really migraine, but it's a cerebrospinal fluid leak that is misdiagnosed as migraine. The diagnosis of migraine is a crucial element, and a lot of people are misdiagnosed. And in people with cerebrospinal fluid leaks, they're finding that the percentage is very high in people with connective tissue disorders like POTS or like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And their symptoms are very different. The migraine symptoms are extremely positional, and they don't quite match the migraine throbbing symptomatology. They are worse with movement like migraine, but they're different. And when you do things like epidurals, you run a risk of increasing cerebrospinal fluid leaks. When you have basically surgical type of procedures like spinal taps or lumbar punctures, it can increase your chance of having a cerebrospinal fluid leak. So definitely need to get advanced imaging and really good diagnosis and persist that. But that can leak out of the nose and out of the various orifices. But chronic migraine does not leak fluid in the scalp. Thank goodness. What people are feeling is in migraine, the scalp tension that people feel is what's called allodynia. Allodynia is an increased hypersensitivity, a central sensitization of the trigeminal nucleus. And it's that nucleus that you find at the mid pons, in that middle part of the brainstem, that gets hypersensitized. And so people with migraine will feel very, very tender, but they don't usually leak fluid out of the scalp. Another person asks, when you say change is a factor in migraines, oh yes, that's the biggest factor in migraine. Can you please be more specific? No, I can't, particularly because the migraineur has to figure out what changes. For me in particular, my biggest precipitator of migraine is hormonal change, and particularly estrogen. So I'm working right now to understand my fluctuations of estrogen better as I approach menopause. I'm 42 now currently. My migraines have definitely improved over the course of time, which is very typical with migraine, particularly in females that have estrogen relationships. But it's not just hormone fluctuations, although we'll discuss that a little bit more today. Today was all about the change, so I'm really glad that you asked. The change in homeostasis, and it can really be anything. It can be barometric pressure changes. It can be changes to your schedule. It can be changes to altitude. It could be changes in time zone, which for me can be a triggering factor since I practice in both Boulder, Colorado, and New York City, which are two time zones apart, so 2 hours apart. And so I fly back and forth on a weekly or biweekly basis. So those can be somewhat triggering. A change in diet, we'll talk a little bit more about that today, about creating any kind of neutrality where there's a minimal amount of fluctuations in homeostasis. Homeostasis is largely monitored by the hypothalamus, and it's part of your diencephalon, part of your deeper parts of the brain. I know we talked a little bit about that last week. And then the pain reception, amongst other things, is monitored by the thalamus, another part of the diencephalon that is very much linked to aura, and it's very much linked to the trigeminal nerve. So the trigeminal nerve and the thalamus are constantly relaying any kind of change that the body's experiencing. And it's the trigeminal nerve is very protective of what's happening in the dura mater. And that meninges, that chicken skin, if you will, that protects the cerebrum and contains the cerebrum and prevents it from injury. Because the trigeminal nerve is also innervating the blood vessels that are basically feeding and draining the brain, it's very, very important to harmonize the relationship between the trigeminal nerve and the thalamus. So change can be biomechanical. It can be people that are suddenly have sleep apnea, people that have progressive sleep apnea or obstructive sleep apnea, people that have temporomandibular joint dysfunction, people that go from not gum chewing to jump gum chewing. That can be something, one of my triggers for sure is chewing gum. So it's very interesting how there's so many effects on trigeminal nerve that you want to sedate and normalize. And so I want to talk this week about that specifically, about change, because we talked about the three major factors of migraine, right? Gender, which we talked about, genetics, we talked about, and then change, the changes to homeostasis, the boring life, the boring repetitive life that the migraineur must go through. So there, I can't elaborate specifically on what triggers people because everyone's different. But I will elaborate on the multitude, the myriad, if you will, of changes that can affect migraine. Great question. The one bonus I'm looking forward to, because someone said life change event. For me, my migraine incidence went up when my father died last year. I had my migraines under enormous control. I was very proud of myself. I created a lot of lifestyle change that I'll share with you and that I recommend to patients. But when I had a very big stressful event, my migraine incidence really went up for a while. And I remember talking to my husband about it, and he had said to me, well, remember the emotional trauma of losing your patriarch, someone you're very close to. And I was like, that would be triggering of migraine, really? And he's like, I think so. And he didn't really know the neuroanatomy behind it. So I started to investigate the neuroanatomy behind it, and he's right. Those stress hormones are they're anti-inflammatory, cortisol is anti-inflammatory, but it can create a big change in the way your chemicals are mediated over cell membranes. And because of norepinephrine is pro-inflammatory, it's a stress hormone that's released with cortisol sometimes. And norepinephrine is the enemy. Norepinephrine is wonderful chemical. It's very important chemical. But if norepinephrine, noradrenaline, precursor to adrenaline, this chemical, it increases pain and it stimulates that a midbrain nucleus called the mesencephalic nucleus that encourages trigeminal nerve action, especially the mandibular division of trigeminal nerve. So the more you stress, the more you grit, the more trigeminal afferents, trigeminal input into the CNS you give into the brainstem. So you end up with this cascade of trigeminal nerve getting irritated, and then trigeminal nerve sending information up to the thalamus, and the thalamus getting bombarded with all this information from trigeminal and saying, what's going on down there? And then there's this five pathway network from trigeminal nerve to the thalamus that your thalamus starts to get confused on what it's relaying. And so life-changing events, stressful events can be really, really big ones. They notice a huge incidence of women when they go through menopause actually improving with their migraines. It's very fascinating. But if you take estrogen therapy, they don't go away. So we know that estrogen is a hormone that can play a big role, which is not super surprising when you think about the fact that what we talked about last week. Remember how we talked about changes in homeostasis can trigger an irritation of the trigeminal nerve, and then the trigeminal nerve starts to release those neuropeptides that are pro-inflammatory, like calcitonin gene-related peptide, right? It's very pro-inflammatory. And that chemical will start to encourage that big potassium change, right, on the cell membrane. And then you start to get this pain response that's associated with the inflammatory soup. So when it comes to estrogen is vasodilative, just like C-reactive protein initiates the mast cells, the immune system. You guys know the lymphatics really well, right? The lymphatic system starts to be activated. The mast cells start to get activated and they release histamine and nitric oxide. And those chemicals, they are vasodilative. Estrogen's vasodilative. And so estrogen can actually encourage these pain cycles of migraine. Also the change in estrogen, for sure. So in women who are taking estrogen-related therapies, they're, hormone replacement therapies to help with their bone density after menopause, or to help with moistening and vaginal mucosa so they don't get dry, things like that. They might not be able to get rid of their migraines as readily. So there's this give and take with hormones. And so hormones do play a part. We're not quite sure the exact role that estrogen plays. The jury's still out. While the understanding has improved over the past decade of what actually promotes migraine, we know that estrogen may play a huge role, especially in people with menstrual migraine like myself. We're not exactly sure the mechanisms, but it is absolutely has something to do with this neuroinflammatory soup and this vasodilation that occurs. And because of that, this almost hyperpolarization of trigeminal nerve and then a depolarization of the cerebrocortical aspect, and that's what encourages the aura. So there's this, it's a neurological disease, folks. Migraine is not a vascular disease like they thought 10 years ago. In the last 10 years, there's a huge vascular components like we talked about last week, but it's a neurological disease, and a lot of it has a big genetic component. So you're not doing anything wrong. You didn't do a bad thing and get migraines. It's not a punishment. And I had to really come to terms with that, because people would blame my busy schedule, and it wasn't ever my busy schedule. It was a change in my schedule that would trigger my migraines. Like if I was stressed and I would come down from change, like I would have like a 50-hour work week, and then I would have a vacation for 2 days, and it would be on the vacation that I would get the migraine. That's something you hear a lot from people with migraine. A huge percentage of people with migraine get headaches after a period of stress is relieved. So we can't live a stress-free life. And stress actually, it can make diamonds, right? You stress, carbon, and it makes a diamond. but it can actually crush you like coal too. So the management of our change, as many factors as you can control, you should control. And that's the big thing with change. And so when it comes to monitoring this with my patients, I ask them, you know, like, what did you forget about the bad days, think about the good days. Like what, and this was advice from Stanford, by the way, just incredible advice that I took to heart, and it was really helpful. Rather than focusing on the migraine, focus on like, what do you do on the days when you don't have migraine that goes so well? And typically what you'll find in patients is they have this normalcy where they get up at 7 and they have their coffee and then they go to bed at 11. And then that day just, you know, really was the same. And then when they threw a wrench in it, either with hormone change, which is inevitable during menses, or any fluctuations in their scheduling or their routine, then it's very easy to perpetuate the migraine. So you have to keep a list. And it can be a lot of things for a lot of people. One of my patients was triggered by a certain smell. She would smell something particular and boom, it would set up this cologne, this particular cologne. And the trigeminal nerve is, you know, any smell that you're getting in, remember the nasal mucosa is innervated by trigeminal nerve. The olfaction is, you know, right in the top of your sinus cavity, and taking in the smells, but the sensory innervation, like if there's a bombardment of olfaction, there might be a bombardment of the trigeminal nerve as well. And so, any kind of bombardment of trigeminal nerve needs to be dissipated for that patient. So for her, you know, I told her, you know, when you have like get bombarded by something, try to use all your self-management techniques to get yourself in check. And we're going to talk a lot about that next week, obviously, when we talk about treatment of migraine. We're going to talk about medication and movement and different interventions that are massively successful for the management of this chronic condition. But for now, commit to what we're talking about with change. Any change is not that great, whether it's schedule, pressures, environment, stress in general, diet, exercise. You want to be a routine person. And that is a huge, huge deal for the migrainer. Wonderful question. I love that question. And the question's big. So you have to really, when you're working with someone with migraine, let them know that change is going to happen and no changes are great for people with migraines. So the trigeminal nerve in particular is very, very sensitive to change, particularly any chemical related changes. Wow. What wonderful questions. I love these. Any more? These are awesome. Basically just piggybacks on everything I want to talk to you about today, which is change. Let me just share a picture while you think of more questions. I just want to remind you of the trigeminal nerve here. So as you start to do research on migraine, you're going to read more and more about the trigeminal nerve. Most of you folks already know a lot about the trigeminal nerve. I know we talked about this last week and we showed it last week, but I cannot speak enough about this, such an important nerve. This is the largest cranial nerve. It has the most amount of sensory axons. It is huge. If you look down at your pinky right now, it's about 3/4 of the size of your pinky. It's huge. And so maybe that doesn't mean much to you because you're like, oh, that doesn't seem so big, but cranial nerves are usually very, very small. And the more sensory axons you have, the more potential you have to activate them, right? The more receptors they have. And we talked last week about, you know, the tip of the nose doing the face wash, right? So V1, V2, V3, those are the areas that are particularly innervated by trigeminal nerve for cutaneous innervation. And then of course, this also includes the temple and part of the ear. So some people can misconstrue it as, you know, ear pain or even, you know, temporal pain from this trigeminal neuralgia that occurs. And this is just the outside world. The inside world is, you know, your eyes, the back of your eyes, the front of your eyes, the nasal cavity, the sinus cavity, the oral cavity, various innervations, the teeth. A lot of migraine sufferers will talk about how the entire half, that half of the face thing we talked about, right? That unilateral pain, that throbbing unilateral pain, and the allodynia that also is covered by the scalp, because you can see part of the scalp is innervated by trigeminal nerve. So there's this playover with trigeminal nerve and this afferents that goes up. And I want to talk to you guys also about the thalamus. Okay. And I also want to talk to you folks about this little ganglion you see here. Do you see this number two? This is a particularly important ganglion for people with migraine. And this is called the pterygopalatine ganglion. The pterygopalatine ganglion. Do you folks know what a ganglion is? I'm just curious. I'm going to stop the share for a second. I am willing to give a poster away to anyone who knows this answer beforehand. I would be very impressed because a lot of people just don't learn neuroanatomy very deep. And I like to explain neuroanatomy in a way that makes sense to people because it could be very verbose. So, does anybody happen to know? A collection of nerves? Not quite. That would be trigeminal nerve. A ganglion is a house of nerve cell bodies. And it typically is where it's located outside of the central nervous system. So the pterygopalatine ganglion that you saw from the picture, it is this incredible place where an autonomic function occurs. So migraine has a huge autonomic component for a lot of people. This ganglion, you might know it as your snot ganglion. And so that's what I call it to my patients. Like, this is the one that helps you produce mucus, the one that also helps you to cry. If you've ever worked with someone with migraine, a lot of them have these symptoms, these nasal symptoms. They're often misdiagnosed with sinusitis. Like for me, I remember going to the ENT and saying, my nose always feels stuffy and my eyes start to water. And that's one of the reasons I know I'm going to get a migraine. And she said to me, ENTs are marvelous, right? She said to me, ear, eye, nose, throat doctor. She said to me, yes, that's actually, that ganglion is related. Its hypersensitivity is related to the trigeminal nerve pain, this trigeminal vascular activating system that triggers migraine. And so she looked in, she was like, you actually don't have a sinus problem. But if I am hypersensitized to normal allergens or hypersensitized to a normal environment because I am a migraineur, then I can actually activate this because of the constant bombardment. The brain kind of, the trigeminal area gets confused. And then there's this activation because this trigeminal nerve goes into a nucleus called the trigeminal nucleus, right? A nucleus is nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system. A ganglion is nerve cell bodies outside of the central nervous system. So basically, there's so much information coming in that there's crossover through these neurons. It's kind of like they throw the baton to somebody else on accident. It's like they throw the baton to someone on the other team. And so what'll happen is you'll activate this nucleus called the superior salvatory nucleus, and it's adjacent to the trigeminal nucleus, right? So what'll happen is you'll start sending efferent or outgoing messages to this, and it gets confused, and you start to get a runny nose, or you start to get some people get some ear fullness. For me, I get really runny eyes. My eyes will start to water for no reason. And then I've keyed that into the next day. Oh my gosh, I have a migraine. So because my trigeminal nerve got hypersensitized, like for me, it's dust. Dust will really do it. I'll get hypersensitized, and then that can really perpetuate the migraine. So that's why you got to keep the nasal area really, really clear. I developed something called the dually nasal protocol, where I have myself and other migraine sufferers keep the nasal pathway clear. I'm never without an Olbus inhaler just to keep everything kind of open and clear so that the trigeminal nerve, doesn't start sending feedback over to this pterygopalatine ganglion. In the research, they changed the name of this to the sphenopalatine ganglion. That's not the true anatomic name, but if you come across it in your research, the sphenopalatine ganglion is the same thing as the pterygopalatine ganglion. Its true name is the pterygopalatine ganglion. But that's this little guy. This little tiny thing right here can be quite the integrator into what the migraine patient is experiencing. So if you have this ophthalmic division of trigeminal nerve right here, right? This is the yellow here. Maxillary nerve, which is the second division, which is the nasal cavity also included in that. Up the palate as well, teeth, upper teeth. And then the green that you see here is the mandibular division. The mandibular division is the largest division, obviously, but it goes from everywhere from the tongue to the teeth and to the temporal mandibular joint. So if you look at all these branches, folks, and think about it, we're going to the eye here, we're going to the forehead, we're going to the maxillary nerve, we're going to the nasal mucosa, we're going to the upper teeth. We're going to the tongue. any increased amount of afferents into these nerves can be very problematic for someone with migraine. So when we talk about therapies next week, I want you to remember that the trigeminal nerve is the nerve of migraine. Okay. And that the trigeminal nerve, we need to create any kind of sedation of the input into this nerve as much as we can control. And what will happen for us is this amazing experience of being able to control migraine much better. Okay. That's an intense picture, right? So I just want to make sure that people don't have any. Oh, we do have questions. Okay, wonderful. Someone said, thank you for talking about smells. Oh, yes. Smells can bring a particular type of migraine than the typical ones. Yes. So the person is asking a great question. Why is this migraine different? Well, as far as what is occurring at the cortical spreading depression, nothing is different. Your experiences as far as symptoms will be different. And it's because of the thalamus. Can I talk about the thalamus for a second? Do you guys know the thalamus? I know that we talked about it with diencephalon, but I want to show you the thalamus a little bit better. And I feel like people don't get this in some of their anatomy classes. And it's a bummer because it's really important. So do you guys see the thalamus here? The thalamus is deep, deep, deep on the inner parts of your cerebral cortex. And so it's part of the diencephalon along with the hypothalamus, right? This thalamus is particularly important for migraine. And so there are different pathways that can trigger a relationship with the thalamus and migraine. Smell can be one because it's a cranial nerve. Smell is, you know, olfaction. And so that can trigger parts of this relay into the thalamus. What I want you to think of the thalamus is like, it is like the bouncer of a club. Have you guys been to a club before? I've been to a club before, not in a long time, but all that whole routine thing and not wanting to create too much change. But if you go to a club, there's typically a bouncer, someone who is security, allowing certain things in, right? So the thalamus is like a relay center for all sensation. The thalamus has to monitor where things are going and whether or not it's important enough to get into the club that is the cerebrum, right? And so the thalamus can be stimulated by those neuropeptides, particularly the calcitonin gene-related peptide, but also substance P, other neuropeptides. And so olfaction is linked to certain peptides. So that's going to trigger part of the thalamus and create probably a different kind of sensation of a migraine than someone who has like a menstrual migraine. It might be completely different symptomatology because that person has estrogen triggering it. So there's maybe a different part of cerebral cortex, a different aura, if you will. If aura is triggering this cortical spreading depression, which is what they think is aura first and then cortical spreading depression, all of that is thalamic mediated, meaning that the incoming information from the olfactory nerve, the incoming information from trigeminal nerve, all of this information is coming into the thalamus and then also relaying information via glutamatergic cells to stimulate the dura mater and produce headache, produce this migraine sensation. So while we have the trigeminal activating system using particularly potassium pathway via this activation of the cortex, the thalamus can directly affect the meninges without the trigeminal's direct help too. And that's most likely the migraine you're experiencing, the olfactory migraine. So you can have visual migraine, you can have olfactory migraine. Most of the time, the migraines, the vast majority of the time, are trigeminal oriented, but it doesn't have to be that way. The fascinating thing about the thalamus is that it is the reason why people get what's called a multi-system migraine. Hardly ever do you hear about migraine just causing a headache. You know how we talked about like the nausea, vomiting sensation, the throbbing, the worse with movement, all those things are very consistent with migraine, right? The unilateral nature. But the thalamus is this relay center for all sensation and also is output for a lot of our management of the way that we see light, the way that we hear sound. And because it is this bouncer of this club, it can get like a hypersensitized. Almost like it's a woo, woo, like calling the cops and the cops aren't needed. It's just a gentle dispute and probably doesn't need to be mediated by the cops. But the thing about the thalamus is that when it gets activated, it starts to call the cops and it changes, you know, the way that we perceive the dura mater, and it creates quite a bit of pain. So the thalamus also doesn't like change, by the way. It wants this normality. It wants homeostasis because it communicates with the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is a huge connection with the thalamus. They're both parts of the diencephalon. And the thalamus is hugely connected to the anterior cingulate cortex, which you see here. And the anterior cingulate cortex is how we feel pain. And how we perceive our environment also. It's part of the limbic system. You guys might know the limbic system as something that takes you home: homeostasis, olfaction, memory, and emotion. So the thalamus is constantly reading all of these signals and trying to determine whether or not it's worthy to be perceived by the owner of this club, this cerebrum. So that's how, like, the multi-system activation, why there's so much going on with migraine, why you feel fatigue, why you feel these weird premonitory symptoms, these things that are like the nausea can be there, the altered light sensations, the photophobia, the phonophobia, so many different sensations are occurred. And you can thank the bouncer of the club for hypersensitizing and basically pulling a fire alarm when one doesn't need to be pulled. That's the thing about someone with migraine, is that they are, it's a hyperexcitability disorder. They're just too excited. It's not a personality disorder, by the way. You might spend time with me for 5 minutes and think that all people with migraine have my personality, and it's not true. It's nothing to do with that. It's not a psychiatric disorder of sorts, although psychiatric disorders can coexist with migraine. It's more that the person has a genetic predisposition, dysfunctional receptors. It gets complicated. And a lot of times there's this problem with the COMT gene and inability to dampen norepinephrine's effect on in the cerebral cortex and trigeminal nerve also, and trigeminal nucleus. So it gets interesting when you think of all the things that you have to control with someone with a genetic potential towards migraine. Another question, can you repeat the anatomical name of the sphenopalatine ganglion? Yeah, it's called the pterygopalatine ganglion. So do you guys know the pterygoid muscles of the jaw? So pterygoid means wing-like, right? So there are these plates of bone in the sphenoid, right? And so it's called the pterygopalatine ganglion because it's between the palatine bone and the medial pterygoid plate of the sphenoid bone. So a good name is sphenopalatine ganglion, but it's also called the pterygo, P-T-E-R-Y-O, pterygopalatine ganglion. It means the same thing because the pterygoid plate is part of the sphenoid bone. So you're like splitting hairs, but I'm just telling you, like, if you look it up in an anatomical text, they'll call it the pterygopalatine ganglion. But if you look it up in research articles, it's called the sphenopalatine ganglion, the same ganglion. And it's a massive, the largest parasympathetic ganglion you have. And it helps you with tearing and mucus production. Very, very important. And its postsynaptic fibers travel on, guess who? The trigeminal nerve, the maxillary division of trigeminal nerve. That's why your trigeminal nucleus and the superior salivary nucleus, they can get bombarded with information. And it's similar, like we talked to last week about referred pain, like kind of like how heart attacks don't actually affect the arm, but you feel something in your arm because it's just too much hyperexcitability of that part of the spinal cord, right? Well, the same thing's happening with migraine. Like you get this, nothing's actually wrong with the pterygopalatine ganglion, but they've done some treatments to create some like intranasal cannulae to kind of anesthetize, to dampen some of the pterygopalatine ganglion's effects. And it's proven to be very helpful with migraine. So it's one of the more progressive treatments we'll talk about next week. Do you see how knowing the anatomy kind of matters? If you're going to understand migraine, it's impossible not to know anatomy and specifically neuroanatomy. We were very confused about migraine for the first 10 years of my migraine. They were mismanaged quite a bit, I think, just because they couldn't find the right medications that were right for the person. For me, the medications made me very sick. That was probably, honestly, my neurologist's fault. Partially. So we'll talk about a little bit more about that next week. But if you know the anatomy, then understanding how you can downplay the afferents into trigeminal nerve and the thalamus can be very, very valuable, more valuable than you know. You guys have so much power to help people with migraine. But first, we have to understand how it's different anatomically than everything else. And a big part of that is the thalamus and the trigeminal nerve's relationship to these neuropeptides. What did the E stand for in home? Homeostasis, olfaction, memory, and emotions. So those four things are what the limbic system controls. And the limbic system is a network of nuclei that are in the midbrain and thalamus, along with the hippocampus, the amygdala, and the cingulate gyrus. And so these anatomical, very medial portions of the brain are basically trying to balance all your chemicals all the time. And remember how we talked about homeostasis is the opposite of change. Homeostasis is your ability to create balance, to create chemical, emotional, proprioceptive balance. And a big part of the treatment of migraine is creating balance for the person, knowing that there's going to be wrenches thrown into things, but if we can normalize as many things as possible, then the person's lifestyle changes and can really help with the management. It's been life-changing for me to go from, you know, 3 to 5 migraines per week where things were completely out of control to, you know, some of these patients are really, really sick. I was really sick at the start of my migraines. And to now talk about them to you guys with a smiling face, I would be scared to talk about it in the past because out of fear, I would jinx it and create like some kind of, you know, superstition of creating migraine for myself. But I'm not that, you know, even though I know my system is hyperexcitable and hypersensitive, I don't fear migraine anymore. In fact, I want to understand it so I can help you folks to understand it, to help people. Someone says, are you saying that not all migraines are caused by trigeminal stimulation? No, they're not all caused by trigeminal stimulation. You can have direct thalamic stimulation through olfaction, through the visual apparatus, there's a nucleus on the thalamus called the pulvinar nucleus. It's the posterior nucleus. And some people can, you know, have a hyperstimulation of the thalamus directly. And then the pain you perceive, though, is trigeminal nerve. Trigeminal nerve is what's innervating the dura. So just because it's not triggered by trigeminal nerve doesn't mean trigeminal nerve is not involved. So that's that pathway. So I can show you here again, because I want you to see it. And maybe you don't know exactly what you're looking at yet, but so cortical spreading depression can actually be created without direct stimulation from trigeminal nerve. Do you see this pathway right here? Like you can go this way, right up to the thalamus and then stimulate, or you can have cortical spreading depression that stimulates directly towards the thalamus. So you can bypass the direct stimulation by trigeminal nerve, but trigeminal nerve is certainly involved. It's certainly involved in your perception. Why you feel the headache part, that's trigeminal nerve. But direct stimulation of the trigeminal nerve doesn't have to be present, although it's often a major factor. So migraine is complicated. Our understanding of it's massively improving. And I think that makes the medications and the lifestyle changes that we suggest to people really, really valuable. These are fantastic questions. You guys asked no questions last week, and now you come with all of these really amazing questions. Thank you so much for being so interested in this topic. Wonderful. I'm so happy for you folks that you want to know these things. Someone says, can you explain the mechanism behind white migraine when you experience extreme cold, unable to keep warm, coupled with the nausea, vomiting? Again, folks, every migraineur is going to experience different symptomatology. Not everybody that has a migraine has the same symptoms. We just know that most people with migraine have these basic symptoms. The change in temperature that you're experiencing, the perception of changed temperature, is due to that relayed information into the thalamus, where your body is going through vasoconstriction and vasodilation of blood vessels. So because of that happening at the trigeminal nerve, because the neuroinflammatory soup is not just released into the trigeminal nerve area, trigeminal nucleus is what releases those chemicals, right? Those neuropeptides, the problem becomes thalamic, which becomes more systemic. So once you start to stimulate the thalamus, then you can create more of a systemic response to temperature regulation due to the thalamus's relationship with the hypothalamus, the tracks that go back and forth. So some people with migraine will have trouble like monitoring temperature. They'll feel like feverish, and then they'll feel like chills, right? And it's because their body is trying to get a balance on vasoconstriction and vasodilation, but also trying to get a balance between too much hyperexcitability of the thalamus and hypothalamus. So hopefully that's helpful and answers your question. Wonderful. Oh my gosh, such wonderful, beautiful questions. Did you guys want to see what the brainstem actually looks like? I thought you guys might want to see that because this is a brainstem disorder in a lot of ways. And so this is a beautiful picture that is provided by my university, New York University. And it's, let me just slow it down because that's really fast. Hopefully it doesn't trigger anybody with migraine. so if you see here, the midbrain is the structure that's right above that big round structure. Let me see if I can pause it right there. So see this big round structure? This is the pons. And right in the middle is the midpons. And so the trigeminal nerve is emanating out from midpons. This is the trigeminal nerve here, right? And so the midbrain is here. And the midbrain is intimately related to migraine also, because the midbrain has the mesencephalic nucleus that kind of has a huge role to play with the trigeminal nerve, especially the mandibular division. And it's why a lot of people with migraine will start to feel the teeth symptomatology, like the grinding or the gritting or the bruxism that can be present with migraine. And also just superior to that, you're running into the thalamus. So the thalamus is just superior to midbrain. And it's huge. As you can see, the pulmonar is going to be more posteriorly oriented like this. And the anterior nuclei that are a little bit more motor oriented or more here. So it's anterior, this posterior. And I want you guys to just see for a second. I'm always fascinated by this. Do you see this gigantic set of axons? These are not nerve cell bodies. These are axons. And this is called the middle cerebellar peduncle. And it's this huge connection between cerebellum and the midbrain, or sorry, the middle part of the pons, the middle pons. And so there's these massive sets of axons that are connecting the pons over to cerebellum. So for if you have patients with Meniere's disease that have migraine as part of their Meniere's disease, then this is part of the reason there's so much afferents going back and forth between cerebellum. I actually don't have this problem per se, but they find a huge percentage of patients with migraine actually have motion sickness. And I fall into a percentage that doesn't have that, but it's a massive percent, 70 plus percent of people with motion sickness actually have a propensity towards at least one migraine in their life, if not chronicity. So there's a play between the information that's going back and forth between cerebellum and the pons, but particularly with Meniere's disease, a particular disorder that affects the vestibular cochlear nerve, this information is related also to facial pain and trigeminal nerve pain. So I thought that was a really cool picture for you to see the thalamus, the midbrain, and the pons, and then the trigeminal nerve right at the middle of the pons. Are you guys fascinated with trigeminal nerve yet? you probably already are. Many of you guys are probably craniosacral therapists or sacrooccipital technique therapists or energy workers that you find yourself a lot up here for people with trigeminal nerve. One thing that's so important that I mentioned last week is that when someone's in the midst of migraine, you don't want to give them more stimulation here. that's something I really want to help promote to you folks in the management of migraine is to sedate a lot of the incoming information that may be overstimulating to the person, to create a sedation. And some of the treatments that we'll talk about, especially ones that kind of link trigeminal nerve to the vagus nerve, next week, some of the neuromodulations we'll discuss it's a really growing field. And I think that we are going to play a huge part in that. And if you're an acupuncturist, you already probably do that a lot. Or if you do a lot of cranial work, then you're already doing a lot of that modulation, especially when someone doesn't have a migraine, like when they're premonitory or way before. Someone was saying that when they have an aura, they get no pain unilaterally, but realize they have a cannonball inside their head. And when they bend down, feels like it's clunking around. So that's exactly what we were talking about last week. And if this is a really, really consistent version of someone with migraine with aura. So 80, you know, two thirds of people with migraine don't actually get aura. And then you're in the third. So basically you may not start with the unilateral head pain because the pain that one experiences like behind the eye that's trigeminal nerve also, that's the ophthalmic division. So basically a lot of people with migraine have this stimulation called aura. It doesn't have to be visual, but for some people it's a change in their visual pathway, a depression of their ability to receive through the visual cortex. So there's this hyperexcitability that occurs, and that's when the cortical spreading depression occurs. So for this person, how do they describe it? A cannonball inside of their head. Yeah, that's like an implosion headache. When they bend down, they feel. So basically we talked about one of the key factors of migraine is people that are motion sensitive, not motion sick necessarily, but that their pain increases with motion of the head. So that's a quintessential symptom of migraine. It's mostly just because it's more afferents into head position and the proprioception that's monitored by trigeminal nerve. There's that major input into the mid pons. And so that's why migraine people want to keep their heads still. And so you fit the pattern of someone with migraine. Not everyone's pain is the same. And that's what I want to relay to you. That's why migraine is so hard to diagnose unless you go to a headache specialist. And I do highly suggest that. Migraine sufferers, they tend to be cast off in the headache category, and people kind of play crapshoot with their headaches, and they may even play crapshoot with their headaches. And getting a really good understanding of not only your triggers, but an understanding of what's actually happening can get you the right diagnosis and then on the road to better treatment. And so the problem with migraine is that the symptoms aren't always the same. The things that we did notice that were the same were the things we talked about last week, right? There tends to be a unilaterality. There tends to be a throbbing. There tends to be photophobia, phonophobia. There tends to be nausea, vomiting, and it's worse with motion. Those are your big five. But the variety of what people experience with migraine can be just myriad symptoms and multiple systems of symptoms. So I would say that it sounds like you have migraine, and it certainly sounds like you have migraine with aura, but your pain may not be the same as anyone else's. Someone asks, where does there seem to be a link with asthma and eczema and migraines? Oh, I would love to talk to you about this. So asthma and eczema are both pro-inflammatory disorders. So if you have a keyed up inflammatory cascade, then it becomes particularly challenging for you if you also have a genetic predisposition towards migraine. And not everybody with asthma and eczema has migraine, but people with asthma and eczema that also have a faulty receptor, a genetic component, the thing that you should know, folks, is that migraines are very, very genetic. Remember, it's one of the three major things: genetic, gender, and change. So when people have asthma is a very keyed up inflammatory cascade, particularly affecting the pulmonary system, right? It's an obstructive pulmonary disorder. Eczema is also pro-inflammatory, and it's a skin disorder. And so what eczema and asthma have in common is, you know, quite a bit of leukotriene activation through the lymphatic system, and it's very, very pro-inflammatory, and they tend to both be chronic, and they both have these weird cyclical natures to them, and they both tend to be triggered by, you know, well, I should say different triggers can ignite them. And for me, like, I wasn't diagnosed with exercise-induced asthma until I was in my like late 30s. I didn't realize you weren't supposed to cough like really, really bad after you ran. I had no idea. And so when I started to look a little bit deeper on being able to control my airway, it really helped with my migraine potential. And so migraine is its own disorder. Okay. No disorder necessarily causes migraine. It's its own disorder, but it can coexist. It can be comorbid with other disorders. And so one of the treatments that they do for migraine, if you go to a headache specialist, is they start to look really closely on how they can create medications for you that help both of your conditions or multiple conditions. Like if you are a diabetic that has migraine, then they want something that helps you control blood sugar because they know that the change in blood sugar can ignite your migraine. So they want to kill two birds with one stone, if you will. Same thing with asthma. They want to probably give you something for the inflammatory cascade for leukotrienes so that you don't have to worry about igniting that inflammatory cascade and also create migraine. So although there's not a direct correlation, if you will, with migraine and asthma and eczema, the causation, all three have inflammatory components. Hopefully that's helpful. Marvelous questions. My goodness, you folks came to play. I'm so excited to call you folks colleagues after these incredible questions. Really, really amazing. One asks, can one recover from LED light sensitivity? Can one recover? I want to make sure I qualify your question properly. Can one recover from migraine that is ignited by LED light sensitivity? If you know that your trigger is LED light, then one would try to monitor that sensitivity towards LED light with protective glasses, with your different medications that we'll talk about next week. You're different. For me, I do a lot of proprioceptive work for it, which we'll talk about next week with treatment. When it comes to triggers are the most important thing to recognize. And with my migraine sufferers, I have to talk to them about, if you're a migrainer, like you have to know what it sets you off. And we talked a little bit about it last time, but the things classically in the literature that set it off are not LED light. The common things that set it off are things like processed foods, nitrites, MSG, sulfites. Those things are known triggers for the pro-inflammatory cascade. You ingest them. The trigeminal nerve actually can sense that also. You ingest them and then digest them, and then you create an event where you can very hypersensitize the trigeminal nerve through those chemicals in particular. Changes in light is usually what triggers people with migraine, not necessarily LED. Like if you're around LED all the time and it was your routine, it probably wouldn't be as big of a factor. It's the change. Like if you went from LED to a regular light. And so my husband and I have worked out a system in our house where we use only really incandescent lights. The computer has a filter on it. So I really try to monitor the amount of light that I get. And after the sun goes down, then I wear protective glasses to help me with the light of a computer or phone, because I do think that light can be a big trigger because it's a change in light. Like the change in light can be a big one. But as far as LED sensitivity, I've not seen any major meta-analyses that show it to be linked as a causative agent of migraine. I think it's probably just a trigger. My best guess is it's a trigger for a person that has light sensitivity and the changes in light, going from an LED to a fluorescent, or going from a fluorescent to an incandescent, going from direct sunlight to no sunlight and LED might not be great for someone that's a migrainer. One person asked, do you find any particular findings on MRI for migraine? Funny you should ask that. That is a great question. There's one, but it might not be very satisfying. They've done some functional MRI studies to show why the migraineur is experiencing what they're experiencing, which is why we know about, CGRP, substance P, the thalamus, the relationship with trigeminal nerve, the quintothalamic pathway, this network of pathways that connects the thalamus to the multi-system presentation, but that you can't run out for functional MRI all the time. You're not going to have that done, right? So the finding that you may have on your MRI, which I had, was some white intensity on a T2 image. You have some increased sensitivity on the T2 image, this whiteness. So it looks like damage to the white matter. And so some people are misdiagnosed with things like MS, and they get really nervous when they see white matter damage. It doesn't have to be multiple sclerosis. In fact, migraine sufferers or migraineurs They do have some damage to the white matter. We don't know if that's genetic and has always been there. You really wouldn't know unless you had a pre-migraine or post-migraine image, or if it's a consequence of the fact that one has migraines chronically, and that this neuroinflammatory soup, if you will, has created a situation of some neuronal damage. The diffuseness is usually cast off as an incidental finding. Typically, they'll see some damage to the white matter, and a neurologist would tell you, very honestly, they will tell you, I think this is an incidental finding, so let's put it off for now, and let's just watch and wait. And that's actually a really smart response, because you don't really want to make a migrainer worry about another thing. That would be another change. And unnecessary worry about that is just really not going to happen. So typically people with migraine, what they want to do if you have a migraine is run an MRI. They did run one on me, just to look for any possibility of any kind of infarct, any kind of, like for instance, my mom had migraines before she was diagnosed with an arteriovenous malformation, a brain disorder. It's a vascular disorder. And so I don't have that vascular disorder, but thank goodness. You want to rule out some of the scary stuff. But most people with migraine, they're going to have, maybe they might possibly have this incidental finding of some damage to the white matter, but we don't know if that's due to the chronicity or due to a genetic factor that's always been there. It doesn't necessarily mean that your brain is dying, you know, like it just means that your brain has been hyperexcited, and that there may be some debris, if you will, left over. And then we see this hyperintensity on a T2 image on MRI. I wouldn't run out and get an MRI and say, hey, do I have the hypersensitivity? Like, no, it is. Honestly, most people that are managing migraine don't run the MRI unless the treatment doesn't work. Like, that's what happened with me. They were giving me particular medications. I really just don't think my migraines were managed well by my neurologist at the time. Nothing against neurologists. They do a great job. But you really want to go to a headache specialist. You don't want to go to a garden variety neurologist. You want to go to a headache specialist. And I didn't do that. I made that mistake. And so I hope that you folks won't. And they would explain to you that they don't really run an MRI out of the gate before they start trying to manage lifestyle and medications, because a lot of times you won't see anything. That's the hard part about migraine. It's a multi-system event, folks. It's not like everyone with migraine will have an elevated C-reactive protein showing they have an increased inflammatory cascade. It's not like all of them will have, you know, problems on blood work. And that's what makes migraine so challenging. What I've been doing, and maybe you guys heard me talk about this when we talked about the pelvic floor, I've been monitoring people's neurotransmitter metabolites through Dutch testing. And so I look at progesterone, estrogen, norepinephrine, epinephrine, serotonin, GABA, because although serotonin is not to blame, although GABA is not to blame, norepinephrine is not to blame necessarily, there is strong research to support that there's dysfunctional serotonin receptors in people with migraine, and dysfunctional COMT being able to balance norepinephrine for migraine. So I want to know that. So I highly suggest people, and we'll talk about this next week when we talk about treatment, but the Dutch testing can be like helpful for people to understand some of the experiences that they may get from a multi-systemic respect. So when it comes to diagnostic imaging, you have Dutch testing, you have MRI, you have those, some blood work if you're having multi-systemic effects, like for menstrual migraines, for instance, tracking the menses and looking at relationships of FSH and LH produced by the pituitary and released by the pituitary, and then the relationship with estrogen and progesterone for fluctuation menstrual cycles. But there is a link to, they can't quite find the huge link to estrogen and testosterone in men to migraine. We know that there is something, but the jury's still out. So you don't have a lot of people that manage migraine running out to test your estrogen and progesterone levels, and they do fluctuate throughout a cycle. So we need to do a better job of probably managing that. And I do look for it. I do track it for people with migraine. So that's where we're kind of stuck with migraine, is there's not a ton of diagnostic imaging for us. And the symptoms are sort of all over the place, and it's different for everyone. That's why it's so hard to diagnose. Folks, just in America, I know we talked about it last week, 34 million people that's one out of like seven or eight people in the United States experience migraine. On a worldwide level, 15% of any population experiences migraine. 3 to 4% of it are chronic. Folks, that's way more people than are diabetic. It's more people that even have heart disease that's diagnosed. And yet, the research is the disparity of the amount of research that's allotted to migraine is really small because it's hard for them to nail down the symptomatology because it's so diffuse and so different for everyone. It's challenging, but we can be part of the solution by better understanding migraine and helping our clients know how to best manage it. And there's no one magic bullet. It's not going to happen. But we are learning more, like the research on CGRP is really coming along, that particular inflammatory soup chemical, that pro-inflammatory excitatory neuropeptide in particular promotes mast cell activation, which causes the vasodilation, which then causes the trigeminal nerve to activate and produce pain. COMT is a particular gene. Yeah, it's a particular chemical that helps to balance norepinephrine. Do you guys feel like you went to neuroscience class? What did we learn today? We learned that a particular thing, and I want to give away a poster to someone who can answer for me the part of the central nervous system, answer in the chat box, the part of the central nervous system that is your relay center activated in migraine, the relay center for all sensation. The thalamus, very good. So Lucy, you're the big winner today. So I'm gonna put my email here. The person who won last week did not email me. I hope that you guys, I hope I spelled it correctly last week. So the person who won last week, make sure you email me too. I think it was Tomas or Tommy. I didn't quite get the name, but Lucy, you are a big winner. So here is my email. So make sure to email me and I will send you an ID nerve poster and you'll see trigeminal nerve on there. So thank you so much for participating. I'm so glad that you won. Yes, don't forget the thalamus is a very big part of the trigeminal nerve, the two T's, right? Thalamus and trigeminal. Those two are huge players in why we experience migraine. So being able to sedate and ameliorate these two particular sets of afferent chemical afferent pathways up to the cerebrum will be very important. If trigeminal is the cute person trying to come into the club, then the thalamus is the bouncer letting the person in. So with the club being the cerebrum, so you can explain it like that to patients so you don't have to use so much science. If they like the science, which some of my patients do, I go right into it. I'm like, this is so cool. This is so neat. And other people, they just want to know that you can help them. So you can do a combination of whatever your clients need, but your understanding shows confidence. And what they need is for you to be confident in your ability to be able to help them because migraine neurons are experiencing a lot of pain and it can really affect their quality of life. If you can be a small piece of their life improvement, they are going to be your patient forever. They are going to value their relationship with you and trust it so much. So thank you so much for coming this week. Next week, we're going to finish everything out with the various treatments. We're going to talk about drug therapies. We're going to talk about neuromodulation therapies. We're going to talk about, of course, your field of work and how you can contribute to helping people with migraine and how all of it can come together in this amazing co-care situation to be the army that the migraine neuron needs of support. So thank you folks so much for coming. I loved your questions. Man, you folks came to play. This is a very exciting lecture for me. Not that last week,
Great.
not that it wasn't wonderful last week. I know you guys were just taking it in and absorbing, but to see you guys listen last week and then come this week with these very prolific, important questions that your clients will ask, it gets you one step closer to helping people with migraine.